Hi, this is Chris from Tri-State Paranormal, Northern Kentucky, and you're listening to Paratrinity Radio.
Views and opinions expressed by Paratrinity Radio and their guests are solely theirs and do not represent the views and opinions of ASPRN or its affiliates.
Welcome to Paratrinity Radio. Your hosts, Mike and Ellie, plan to delve into the controversial subject of religion and the paranormal.
Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray to God in my soul to keep.
Paratrinity Radio, where nothing is sacred. Powered by the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Paratrinity Radio. I am your host, Mike.
And I am your other host, Ellie.
And we have, or had, or might have, or could have, an excellent show lined up for you. Our guest is set to be Corvus Nocturnum. He is a Satanist, vampire, and author. And we hope to be talking to him about everything he does and what he's all about. We're having some troubles getting a hold of him, so we're going to talk amongst ourselves for a while here and hopefully bring him in soon.
Sorry, go ahead.
Right. That was an awkward moment of silence. So.
You're just weird.
I saw the train go right off the tracks right there. Choo!
Pretty much. So I wasn't prepared to talk amongst ourselves for a while here. So I'm going to babble about the upcoming shows. So next week, we don't have a show. Next week, we will not be here. We might be playing like a repeat pod or something. That's up to our producer, and we'll figure that out throughout the week. And then on April 24th, the guest is still to be confirmed, so I can't tell you that week either. However, starting in May 1st, we have a girl named Rhea Sunshine. I met her on Facebook, and the first thing she said to me was, "You're an alien." And I said, "That's perfect. You want to be on my show?"
Yeah, you do. Actually, you kind of strike me as an alien.
She's some sort of psychic and stuff, she's spiritual of some sort. I don't know if she's a spiritualist or what, but.
That's real good.
Yeah, talk, I'm trying to read.
Why do I have to talk? Why can't you talk and read at the same time, like normal people?
Because I'm not able to multitask.
It's that female-male conundrum. Females are supposedly able to multitask while males can't.
No, just I can't at the moment. Because I'm not good at typing and talking. You should know that. You always try to talk while I type, and that's when I don't listen to you.
Hello.
Or pay attention.
Hello. How are you?
Not too bad at all tonight.
All right. We have Corvus on the line here. That's who you hear talking. And welcome to Paratrinity Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
No problem. Thanks for coming on. So let's start with a little introduction of who you are and what you do. I know you've written a couple of books, Lore of the Vampire, Our Sexual Attraction to the Undead, and Embracing the Dark, Understanding the Dark Subcultures, among many others. I was looking at your website, and I was just scrolling down, like, wow, that's a lot of books. Just kept on going.
Well, I would say that's a small amount of ones that I have in the works at the moment. I just got contacted by Schiffer Books to do one with them called Cemetery Gates is the tentative title, and probably another dozen on my own outside of that.
Wow. Are they all vampire related?
No, actually, just one or two of the dozen that are in the works at the moment. There's going to be a rather wide variety of all different types, from a remake of Edgar Allan Poe anthologies, H.P. Lovecraft. I like doing anthologies, contributing to them, and you know, I love secret societies, colorful characters throughout history. You know, I guess you call them scallywags and con artists, things like that. And there's going to be a wider variety of titles coming from Dark Moon Press in the coming several years.
Are they both fiction and nonfiction, or are they all nonfiction?
Most of them will be nonfiction. There may be a few fiction anthologies here and there that we put out on various topics like zombies, a werewolf collection, you know, just little short fiction pieces.
Okay.
I like zombies and werewolves. Those are fascinating subjects to me, at least.
They're quite popular lately, so, yeah.
There was actually a show on the other day about real werewolves.
Yes.
The cryptid creatures, which I think is, I don't believe in them, but that's just me. So the allure of the vampire and Embracing the Dark, I assume, are both nonfiction, right?
Right. Embracing the Darkness, Understanding Dark Subcultures was my first book written in 2005, released May of 2006, I believe, and it covered a very wide variety of counterculture people, from BDSM, vampires, Satanists, witches, people that were into Gothic culture, art and music, the pierced and tattooed communities. It really ran the range, and because I was so interested in so many different types of different people, it kind of made me branch out into other topics.
That's pretty cool. I mean, that's a lot of research, too. I would imagine that it took a while.
Oh, yeah. Most of my books take anywhere from a year to five, depending on, you know, how difficult the subject. Like I'm working currently on the archetype of Lucifer and, you know, how Satan has evolved since pre-Christianity up till now. And that book has taken about 4 years to research, and I'm not even halfway done with the rough draft.
Wow.
Wow.
There's a lot to it.
I would imagine so. Could you, you know, tell us a little bit about that, or you want us to wait until the book comes out?
Well, I'm going to try to have that one out by the fall of next year if I can. If not, then definitely the following spring.
I remember when I was writing my book about the haunted places here, it was a good 5 years of research, spending lunch hour from work and after work, like every day at the main library downtown, and then when I got home looking online at stuff, and it takes a lot of work. And then when you're doing stuff like you, that's not quite as, I guess you could say, common knowledge, it's just history of a city. I could imagine that's very difficult to even just find your research, never mind doing the research once you find it.
Well, of course, there's a lot of information on subjects that are as popular as what I talk and think about, but I do take them in a slightly different direction than is normal. And I don't base a lot of my research other than the rough draft idea tidbits from online, because, like anything else, it's done by people and there can be mistakes. My personal library is over 500 or 600 titles. I don't even know exactly how many I have. I've been trying to create a database for them so I can organize them a little better. But I spend a lot of time at used bookstores and occasionally Borders, Half.com, things like that, to get most of my research material.
And that's a good thing to kind of do for research, because you want to make sure that you're getting all aspects of the information and not just only one person's point of view.
Right. I mean, in my own personal collection, I mean, I'm a member of the Church of Satan, so of course I have almost every book written by people of the order. But at the same time, I even have books by, you know, theologist Jeffrey Burton Russell, who did this series on Lucifer from the Middle Ages. I've got a few books, even surprisingly, some people may think, from Bob Larson, the radio talk show host that is very antagonistic to Satanism, because I believe in having a wide background to pull my information from, and I like to know what both sides think. I mean, I can't be firm in my own convictions if I don't know what everybody else thinks who's against me, so to speak.
Right. And I think that's what makes an author or
a person,
a teacher, good at what they do when they're open-minded enough to allow all aspects and all views and all sides of it to be included, and they're not single or
minded, yeah,
single-minded or
narrow,
too narrow, or too narrow to really include it all. I think that makes it much better. So,
well, it makes it also hard to be persuasive. I mean, if you're trying to, you know, explain to somebody why they should be, you know, a part of this or a part of that, if you don't know both sides of the coin, how are you going to be persuasive?
And that's part of my reason for researching as much as I do, because I'm a very firm believer in know all sides of a story. I mean, of course I'm going to put my own influence and personality and comments here and there from what I think if I get something from history. But, you know, that's that way with anyone who writes anything. Even if you try to be objective, it's very difficult not to interject your own thoughts.
Yeah, right. It is difficult.
So in your research, do you interview people? Do you talk to a lot of people as well?
Not as much as I used to, mostly because the very first book that I wrote, it comprised probably, you know, a third to a quarter of it was interviews with people. And my reason for that during the time is I wanted it to not be just my own thoughts. I wanted to reach out to the people in the different subcultures and get their take on it, to really be able to relate to everybody. And what they did is they added an element that I thought was important when my personal research and writing was the history of the culture that I think even the people who were involved may not understand or even know. Then I would put my own thoughts and feelings and give somebody else's perspective and then do an afterword and, you know, things like that. I threw in a lot of pictures here and there to illustrate my points. And then after that, most of my work would be a little more academic, and you know, I tried to maintain a little bit of a scholarly approach to it.
Okay.
And then I'd throw in, you know, some comments from other authors or people that were a little more experts in their field, because I wanted to make it clear that I wasn't just going by my own thoughts on everything.
Right.
Right. So when you were talking to people, was pretty much everyone you talked to people of the occult?
Yeah, the people, of course, in the BDSM community come from all backgrounds, doctors, lawyers, Christians, you know, atheists. So the majority of them don't have an occult background, so to speak. Very few of them actually do. Even the ones who are more gothic, you know, in nature might be, or may not be, you know, of an alternative religion. They may be a little more likely because they're, you know, say more questioning in everything, every aspect of their lives. But I don't want to make it a blanket statement either, because it's so diverse.
Right. So when you were talking to these people that aren't so much involved in the occult, they're not a vampire or a witch or all the other occult things, did you find that they were very forthcoming and happy to talk to you, or did they kind of...
I think it's rather interesting in what is known as the lifestyle in BDSM, that they are a little more afraid to come out because they do try to maintain a little more privacy in their activities because of the taboo. And you also have to stop and think that they mostly come from a normal white bread America, you know, life and jobs and things like that. So, you know, they don't want to be seen. The other people, people that live the vampire lifestyle or goth or whatever, they're outwardly, you know, freaky to most people. So they don't care so much. So you really have to understand the perspective that every group comes from.
Well, yeah.
Because I would think a lot of people that aren't real familiar with it, when they hear vampire or Satanist or even witch, that they would kind of start to kind of turn away. And I hate to say that, but it seems to be the stereotype that everyone has gotten, where it's you're bad people, I guess you would say.
Unfortunately, yeah. That is the reason why I felt I had to write that book first, because it was so necessary for people to try to understand each other, that dark isn't evil, and people just want to be understood. They're trying to express their inner self, and it seems to be shameful to other people to even be confronted by it.
Yeah, right. It can be. I mean, I guess it's, unfortunately, you know, just left over from when people started becoming a society, that we get all these prejudices instilled in us. And, you know, it used to be that if you were a tattooed person, not that there's anything wrong with them, because I have tattoos, that you were some, you know, a part of a gang member, and that if you saw them, you should cross the street because they're going to get you.
Well, even I was growing up, having a pager, they said, my parents thought I was some thug that was going to kill someone because I have a pager. I mean...
Are you serious?
So the tattoos and piercings is another step from that. It's always been a, I guess, nasty stereotype.
Right. I'd have to agree with that statement, because I do tend to look at myself a little bit more of not only a researcher, but, you know, an amateur sociologist. And when you stop and think about how people change, they don't really change that much. They just pick a new thing as a collective to say, oh, that's bad, that's wrong. Like you said, in the old days, someone tattooed was instant convict or biker or whatever, and now it's so popular, everybody and their grandmother has one, so they just have to find a new target to, you know, level charges like that.
Right. I mean, well, there is, in fact, a grandmother who is extremely tattooed. She has to wear a wig, but that's besides the point. When you got to talking to them, what insights did you find out that maybe you kind of thought differently before that changed your mind after talking to them?
Well, I don't think I had any real preconceived notions about people that were different, because I identified more with them as, you know, sort of gothic myself when I started out. You have to remember, that was 5 or 6 years ago. You know, I was in my late 20s when I first started researching it, into my 30s, and I always felt different, an outcast. You know, when Columbine happened, I was still at the end of my high school years, and, you know, it's really something to look back thinking about people. And even though I'm in college now, you know, I've been a publisher for a while, I have some respect, and I do feel a certain kinship too, even the younger kids that go to Hot Topic, and, you know, I don't personally like the whole emo thing, you know, I can relate to their mindset and where they're coming from. You know, right. I can be as professional as the next person in a suit that I wear on an average day, but it doesn't mean I've lost the inner flair for understanding and identifying with, you know, someone who wants to rebel a little bit or express themselves differently than the accepted norm.
Right. And I think a lot of people kind of forget about that, that at some point they too wanted to be different, wanted to express themselves, and then they just kind of get to a certain point in their life and they just forget about it and, you know, conform.
I think it's very sad that people feel forced to conform, and some, if not more people than not, will just settle into what they think society or their family or friends expect out of them and never even make the attempt.
Yeah,
I respect people more who venture out a little bit and do something that's different. Even if they go back to it and say, that's not for me, at least they made some sort of, you know, inner leap into the darker psyche of themselves, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of stick out like a sore thumb. I mean, I can't hide who I am, because, you know, not just of my color, I talk a lot. But, and for me, you know, I understand being different and realizing that you're different and that you don't fit in with, you know, different groups. And after a while, you just understand that about yourself, and some do conform and some don't. I try to just be me, such as it is.
Something people forget about is being who they are, who they really want to be, and being happy instead of accepting what they think they need to be.
When did you realize that you wanted to, or when did you realize you were a vampire? At what point in your life did you realize that was the way you wanted to go or needed to go? And how hard was that transition with, as far as society accepting it?
I think when it comes to vampires, it's more a archetypical identity. It's more a longing for past mysteries and a time that you can't possibly get back into, but you feel somewhat alien to the world that you do live in. I guess some people that talk about past lives, and you know, they have a wistfulness about, you know, a bygone era, and you feel like you're ancient, so to speak. That's the inner spark that I have with that. I love the whole gothic aesthetic and the old world classics of art, music, literature, things like that. So there's a lot of appeals to that type of thinking, and I think I identify with that most of all. You know, what you would call the aesthetic or lifestyle vampire instead of just the person that wears the cape and the fangs. I think that's, you know, a bit much.
Right.
Yeah. There are a lot of people out there I grew up with myself that would wear the fangs and the capes and, of course, do the stereotypical blah, blah, I want to suck your blood, and, you know, silly and weird things like that, instead of actually understanding what it was they were doing.
I think there's no harm in it when, you know, you're preteens, you know, a kid on Halloween, that sort of thing, or if you're a high-paid movie actor. Johnny Depp has always wanted to play Barnabas Collins, and he's getting his wish, you know, at 40-something. So I think if you just keep it in the proper mental perspective, there's no harm in wanting to be a vampire, but people that actually think they're immortal and can't be harmed, well, they end up on, you know, 1,000 Ways to Die type shows, you know. And, you know, that's just thinning out the herd.
Yeah, well, Darwin at its finest.
Exactly.
So I'm sure a lot of people out there question what a vampire really is, because, I mean, I'm sure you ask this every show you're on, every time someone talks to you, but you watch movies and they're portrayed the one way. They suck your blood, they stay up at night, sleep during the day.
Well, I'm guilty of the second part there.
Immortal.
Yeah.
I kind of am too. I wouldn't say I'm a vampire. And how is the real vampirism different from the movies? Is it completely different? Are there any similarities?
There's a lot of similarities. I mean, that's why the lifestyle subculture of the vampires are so drawn to that name, to that identity. Avoidance of sunlight because of actual physical medical problems. You know, you have people like myself that's very sensitive to light vision-wise or skin. I've got part native blood, so I don't burn as quickly as most people, but people joke and say, well, you're the palest, you know, Native American I've ever seen. I said, well, it's partly because of all the Irish, and I sleep during the day, too. So when you don't see sun for 3 years, it tends to fade no matter what. But,
yeah.
You know, you've got people that relate to the vampire archetype, whether it's, you know, they like the trappings like myself, or there's some that don't even go for the look of it. They go for more of the identity of being an outsider to the rest of the world. Some do actually ingest small amounts of blood safely from donors that they screen, just like you would for STDs and things like that. They feel that it is a medical need or a spiritual link to the other person. So,
kind of like a person with porphyria?
Yes. So there's a lot of different types and styles of vampires. You will not get one person out there who will describe to a T exactly how they are and find four or five other people in another city who are exactly like that. There's certain overall characteristics. My book talks about it. Another one by author Joseph Laycock talks about it in Vampires Today. There's a study done by Catherine Ramsland in Piercing the Darkness. She was one of the very first authors quite some years ago who was diving into the subculture. And I believe that book came out about 8 or 9 years ago. So, you know, just because it's becoming so popular right now with Twilight and True Blood, it seems like everybody is knowledgeable about the living vampires, but before it was very heavily guarded, you know, in the shadows, so to speak.
Do you think all the, I guess, media, the True Blood and the Twilight and all that is hurting the reputation, I guess you could say, of the real-life vampires, or has it only helped get you more notice and accepted?
Well, I'm of two minds of that myself, because on one hand, I understand and appreciate the elders in the community that say that they would prefer to stay hidden in the shadows, but once, you know, that's been exposed, there's no going back. Others are saying that it's good for the community because they find more acceptance when they're featured on television shows and ABC's 2020 and things like that. Without understanding these people, there can be no acceptance of them. There's only stereotyping or name-calling or whatever. So in some ways, it has been helpful. In other ways, it's harmful because too many crazy people will try to, you know, be involved when they have no business in it. It's also harmful because there are individuals in the community that have kids. And, you know, if someone is afraid that their children will be taken away because they're living that lifestyle, you know, that's why people in the BDSM community won't be as public. You know, there is a stigma for being different, and we live in the real world, so there's a lot of pros and cons to it. So as a researcher and writer, I do try to be fair and unbiased in how I express these things to people. So it's difficult to pigeonhole it. You can't put everybody in the same category.
Yes, just like you, not every vampire it twinkles in the sunlight.
Everybody hates that part. A friend of mine, Michelle Bellinger, was on Nori's Coast to Coast, and she had to clarify to 500,000 people, vampires don't sparkle. That was written by one author out of hundreds of writers over decades, and a lot of people are very mad about that.
I've read a lot of Bram Stoker's Dracula and various other books, you know, like The Vampire Chronicles from Anne Rice. I love those books. And not once did I read about a vampire twinkling in the sunlight. And I think it kind of bothered me because it was just, I guess, just so out there. And just, it's kind of one of those things where it just seems innocent, but when you know that there are others out there who believe in that lifestyle and are a part of that religion, it kind of perpetuates stereotypes that you don't necessarily want perpetuated. And you don't want to have to go out on Oprah and say, hey, that's not right. That's not what we do.
Well, I think that part of the problem there is so many people aren't clear that there is a distinction between fiction and people that live the lifestyle because they identify with an archetype.
Mm-hmm.
And in saying that, I have to be a little more clear in my interviews and in my books to try to distinguish the two, because there are a lot of crazy people out there, like the Rod Farrells and psychos that go out and kill people, and you know, they say, I did it because I'm a vampire. And that really tarnishes people that are trying to live healthy, productive lives that are very much into the subculture. And the other is, you know, based on people that would pick any type of character or figure like Napoleon or Jesus or something and say, I can do this. And, you know, you really have to take it into the context of the mentality of the person who's doing it. Clearly they're crazy, they deserve to be locked up or worse, and they're in no way, shape, or form connected to the lifestyle. You know, they're not representatives, you know, of the community at all.
Well, I mean, that's just like saying that, well, all wealthy white men all end up becoming, you know, serial killers.
Well, that is the majority
just because
of them.
Yes.
It's the white male, 30 to 40 years old, that is doing most of the serial killings throughout history. But it doesn't mean that your occasional female like Arlene Wuornos or Elizabeth Bathory, as the first known serial killer, isn't capable of it.
And it also doesn't mean that every white male that's between 30 and 40 that you meet is going to kill you. Unless you're annoying, but that's a different story.
All right, well, I think we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, I wanted to delve into Satanism and how or if your religious beliefs, your beliefs in Satanism correlate to your vampirism, and if they have anything to do with each other, and find out more about you. We're talking to Corvus Nocturnum, for all those who came in late. He is a vampire. Fire Satanist and author of many books. And you're listening to Para Trinity Radio on the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network.
Where nothing is sacred.
Joni and Mike of Egypt Valley Paranormal Investigations bring you EVP Spirit Talk every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network.
Mike and Joni team up to bring you EVP Spirit Talk every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Mike and Joni from Egypt Valley Paranormal Investigations plan to delve into the unknown and unheard of the paranormal every week on the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network, only at ASPRN.com.
Hi, this is Marla Brooks, host of that bewitching show, Stirring the Cauldron. And you're stirring it up right now with Michael and Ellie on Paratrinity Radio, where nothing is sacred.
And we're back.
Yes, we are. Sorry.
I'm very authoritative.
Yes, well, we are back.
You had, like, emphasis in there. I was impressed. But anyway, if you're listening and you're not in the chat room, come over and join us here at ASPRN.com/studio.html. And we are talking to Corvus Nocturnum.
A great person.
Indeed. All of our guests are wonderful.
You're welcome.
And for those of you that may have tuned in during the break, he is a vampire, Satanist, and an author of a great deal of book, great number of books.
Spit it out.
I'm having troubles, that's for sure. So, like I said before the break, I kind of wanted to delve into more of your religious background, and even if you have any experience in the paranormal and such. So, first of all, you're a Satanist, correct?
Right. I joined the official Church of Satan back around the same time that I wrote my first book. There's a lot of misinformation on that. I could probably do a book strictly on that itself. I do give lectures on the misconceptions and stereotyping, the debunking Satanism itself. And I have
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I happen to be a warlock, second degree within the order.
Wow.
Oh, wow. Okay. Before I talked to you last night, like kind of, I guess, our pre-show interview or whatever, I really had no idea what Satanist meant, and I just kind of assumed it meant you worship Satan instead of God.
And that would make us a reverse Christian, and that doesn't fit.
That's kind of what I always thought it was. I'm like, so is Satan God to them, and God is their Satan? And it didn't quite make sense to me. So do you want to kind of explain your beliefs? I mean, I know there are different types.
To clarify that particular aspect, theistic Satanists do believe that Satan is their deity, and it is inverse Christianity, which has been around since the Luciferians during the Carthar Age, shortly after the Crusades. So there is a rather lengthy history on devil worshippers, but we do draw a huge distinction between the Church of Satan that was founded back in, I believe, 1966, around this time, where it was more the de facto Satanists that came before us, like Nietzsche, Thomas Paine, Ayn Rand, even aspects of Mark Twain's writing, Lord Byron, the classic author during the time of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, people that were more objectivist. You know, you could even call them atheists with macabre trappings. So there's a huge difference, even though on the surface a lot of people confuse the two.
So the devil worshippers, when I hear the ghost stories about places being haunted because there were satanic rituals and stuff, are those types of people the type that do like animal sacrifices and stuff like that, or is that completely different?
Yes, that's totally different. Now, there is satanic magic and ritual, and I'll go into that a little bit deeper here in a minute, but there is no animal sacrifice in Satanism as of the Church of Satan. We believe very strongly in the fact that children and animals are the most pure of spirit and heart. They believe that they identify more with satanic principles of not being crushed by the dogma of other beliefs and, you know, you have to do this, don't feel or, you know, act how you want. Children and animals have what we call satanic virtues, who will act on their urges. And the only thing that adult Satanists are slightly different than that is we've learned how to tailor those things so that we're Epicureans, not hedonists. You know, you have to do everything within a sensible, logical balance.
Right, because you don't want to be like at Woodstock and pee in the fields.
Exactly. as far as a deity, LeVay proposed that if all God's creations, you know, were, you know, people, were worshiping an external deity and worshiping the Creator by proxy, you know, people. So he suggested that rational Satanists should then internalize their own gods and therefore worship themselves, hence the satanic maxim, I am my own God. And I don't mean to, you know, be too egotistical, even though we believe in the ego, and anti-herd conformity. When we talk about the Godhead, the inner God that we are, we're talking about the personal ideal of human potential, the maximum that we as a human being can become. We picture ourselves in our mind's eye flawless, and we always try to strive to be that as hard as we can. We're perfectionists. We're very driven by our own willpower more than anything else. So it's not that we see ourselves as a god, but as a god figure. And when you worship yourself, you're just acknowledging that succeed or failure is all on you. That's a huge responsibility. That's not projecting and saying, I'm going to succeed because I'm going to pray to God and he'll give me everything.
Right.
We kind of see that as kind of stretching the bounds of reality and common sense. If you want to become and achieve, it's up to you. It's even an old Christian saying that God helps those who help themselves. Well, if that's the case, you're doing all the work anyway. Satanists just laugh at it and cut out the middleman, and we're doing all the work, so we're going to take the credit for it.
It almost seems like, you know, when you were talking about, people will just sit there and say, well, I'll pray to God and he'll give it to me. It seems almost like a cop-out, as if, well, I don't want to take the responsibility of having to get up and do the work. So if I just pray, he'll give it to me anyway.
Exactly. One of the highest elements, you know how the Wiccans have the Wiccan Reed, the Rule of Three, and Christians have the Ten Commandments. Well, in Satanism, you have the 11 satanic rules of the earth, you have the 9 satanic statements, and you have the nine satanic sins. So all in all, we have more rules of what is acceptable behavior for the self and to others than almost any other real religion in the world.
So how are those rules in comparison to, say, the Ten Commandments?
Well, there are a lot of similarities, but they're not as much. The only polite way to say it is they're not victims. Where Christianity says turn the other cheek, Satanist says don't mess with me, or I'll make you suffer tenfold. It's kind of a do unto others as they do to you. We don't go out of our way looking for trouble. You know, don't get me wrong. We're not bullies. We're not people that will go out of our way to cause trouble, because the rules of the earth is don't give opinions or advice unless you're asked. Don't tell your troubles to others unless you're sure they want to hear them. When in another's lair, show them respect or don't go there. Don't make sexual advances unless you're giving what LeVay called the mating signal. If you know what I mean? It's someone who bats their eyes and you know they're interested in you. Acknowledge.
Says from here, big boy?
Yes, exactly. Don't complain about anything you don't need to subject yourself. Don't harm little children. Don't kill non-human animals unless you're attacked or they're for your food. And the one that gets me the most is, when in walking in open territory, bother no one. If someone does bother you, you ask them to stop. If you don't, you destroy them in any way possible, whether it means you bully them and humiliate them, you ask for law enforcement to step in. Using the word destroy is such a vague term, LeVay often had to clarify what he really meant, because some people would instantly want to jump on the word and say, ah, you're saying if someone cuts you off in the street, you're going to kill them. You know,
right.
Don't be stupid. That's the biggest satanic sin. And we do have sins within our organization, believe it or not.
So what's the, I guess you could say, punishment after life for sinning? Like, to me, it's Satan, hell, as a Christian. Punishment is Satan or hell. So for you, what's the, quote, punishment?
The punishment is not in the afterlife. We don't really prescribe to an afterlife. It's everything in this lifetime, in this carnal existence of man. So therefore, if you do the satanic sins, which is stupidity, is on the top of the list. It's more about
a lot of people.
Yes, it's too bad stupidity isn't painful, because ignorance is one thing, but society increasingly strives on, you know, stupidity. If any of you guys have ever seen Idiocracy, it's a very satirical movie, but it's scary because it's so true that the average person, as time goes on, becomes more and more stupid. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that in public now. The No Child Left Behind is a prime example. They're just pushing people through because they have to, not because they're actually taking the time to educate them.
Well, the teachers that are actually trying to educate usually get slapped with the, you know, something from the parents or the school board, and they go through so much red tape that after a while they just burn out and they say, what's the point?
Exactly. You see, when you talk about is there a hell for Satanists, there is. It's not being happy. It's not following your dreams. It's being surrounded by people that bore you to tears. It's being around people that try to crush your dreams. And you allow it. We don't have to accept these things in our life. We don't have to wallow in self-pity and misery. If we are our own God figure, it's up to us to make our life everything that it could be. I waited till I was in my 30s to go back to college to get a better degree, better life, you know, find another publisher than just self-publishing everything to make a better income. You know, you're in charge of your own destiny. If the ideal archetype of Satan is the stubborn accuser, the rebel, you know, the ultimate rebel, then what are we rebelling against? We're rebelling against being like everybody else, being controlled by dogma, whether it's political, religious, or otherwise. So the hell for a Satanist is living like everyone else, not fulfilling your dreams and your own personal destiny of what you can reach out and claw your way to. We never said it's easy, but never give up either.
Right. Well, of course it's not easy, but reward if it's given to you on a silver platter.
No, I'm not saying I wouldn't like to win the lottery, but
well, no.
You know, I feel very proud, and pride is part of Satanism, and what I've accomplished with my life, because years ago, I worked at McDonald's. I was homeless for a while. I joined the Army in order to get my life back on track and, you know, find a little stability, a place to stay, and some money. But as soon as I shook off all that, and I realized what I needed to do to make my life what I wanted, because I'm ultimately responsible for myself. You know, a Satanist will not say, it's the other guy's fault, my life sucks. No, they might do things that make your life more difficult. That's what people do. But it's up to you and what you do about it that matters.
Right. Now, we have a question from Joni in the chat room. Is it okay to hurt others in your quest for what you want?
That's a very loaded question. When you say hurt other people, it's not okay to step on those who have helped you. It's not okay to just, if I can use the non-PC term, be a jackass because you want to get ahead. Because
right.
I've often lectured to people that I'm known as a nice Satanist. And that seems like a contradiction of terms, but it's not. You see, I put myself out there as nice and doing for others, but not to my own detriment, simply because in the career that I have as a writer, as a lecturer, how far would I get in my pursuit of, you know, a better income and, you know, enjoying my life if everybody thought I was a jerk? I stay nice because it benefits me and because I enjoy being nice. I don't like to, you know, be rude to people unless they really push me for it.
Right.
So, you know, you don't step on people's
head. That's common sense, too.
Well, you just hit the nail on the head. Satanism is a religion of common sense. It's about practicality. It's about pride. It's about the individual succeeding. And you don't succeed if you're cruel to others, unnecessarily. But don't allow yourself to be a doormat either. It's finding the balance in between. And, you know, we call ourselves the third side perspective for a reason.
I was reading recently about, you know, in business, those that are overly nice, that are just, okay, you know, how can I help you? How can I help you? Don't get far, but yet those that are just completely cruel and unyielding, unbending, don't get far either. And like you said, it has to be a balance. Sometimes you have to say, well, this isn't what I want. This is not how it's going to be. And sometimes you have to compromise in order to move yourself ahead.
Right.
So you were talking about LeVay and his book. Is that the, I guess you could say, like, the Bible of Satanism, or is that just a book about it? I mean, is that the dogma?
There is no real dogma to Satanism. They do have their rules and they have their regulations, but that's just a codifying manner of thinking that it clearly lays out what is common sense to other people. Or what should be. I like to tell people that common sense really shouldn't be called common sense because it's not very common.
True.
You know,
especially when you're around people today, but yeah.
Exactly. So I like to tell people Satanism is a religion, but it's a religion of objectivism of Ayn Rand. It's the anti-herd of Nietzsche. It's all about questioning dogma. It's about the championing of the individual. It's about using common sense. All of these things weave together. What Anton LaVey did is he took all these other great writers and thinkers in history that he agreed with, and he simply smashed it all together and put the dark trappings, because he felt Satan was the best attention getter and the best archetype that fit the umbrella term for all of these schools of thought. And he called his faith Satanism. He was the first person to ever have the guts to stand up and say, we are the ultimate rebels.
Okay.
See, it's amazing at how many, just, what am I trying to say? Can't seem to get it out. I know what I want to say, but I just can't seem to spit it out. But I guess that's normal habit, but at times. It's just amazing to me, though, the fact that he had the will and the guts to stand up and do that, because especially, you know, at that time period where if you were black, things were horrible.
Right. And that's when we had the big thing with Martin Luther King during the 60s and 70s, and Kennedy and everything that was going on with the hippies in Vietnam.
Right. And to stand up at that time, like, you know, Martin Luther King did and Kennedy and various others did at that time, is, you know, it says a lot about him. Because it, well, actually, no time is really a great time. There's always a lot of strife at some point in life, but that just seems kind of extra, especially in this country. But, you know, that makes him a much more interesting person in my mind, that he was able to do that.
He's a very charismatic and colorful individual. He looked like a carnival strongman with a shaved head and a goatee. He had a pet lion and a boa constrictor, and for his era, that was really shocking. He was very out there in his scholarly aspects and loving the paranormal, the occult. He was very big on secret societies, and that helped shape the secretive nature of the Church of Satan, because so many people that are members are not public about it. They can't afford to be. I mean, I have the luxury of being an author and lecturing on these subjects, and it helps me for people to know what I am sometimes, because that gets attention and people are asking, what is Satanism? I'm like, here, I wrote a book that has, you know, detail on it, and I explain it. I go give lectures. You know, I do radio shows like this one. But not everybody is as fortunate, and they can't let it out. It's like I said about people in the BDSM world or vampires. When you're a member of the Church of Satan, it may be one of the few alternative religions that is protected in the Constitution. In the U.S. Army Chaplain Handbook, it's listed, just like Wicca, as a government-sanctioned religion. But it doesn't mean the rest of the world is going to give you kudos for coming out with, oh, you wear a Sigil Baphomet. You know, they're not going to take it easy on you. You know, you're more hated being a Satanist than you are being a Muslim in America.
Wow.
Right.
So how does your religion get to be at, you know, government sanctioned, whereas, say, Kabbalah or some others aren't necessarily, well, I don't know about Kabbalah anymore. They may have, but there are certain ones that aren't. What makes the government recognize certain ones and not all of them?
Well, I believe it's because not only do they have a Bible, but they have specific rituals. They have specific holidays that are always observed on the same dates. That is part of the criteria that the government uses to measure. They have an exact accountable membership. They have a hierarchy and organization within it that remains in place since its founding. It just gets handed down to whoever is appointed. It follows the structure that's required, whereas Kabbalah and voodoo and things like that is so scattered and loose, it's eclectic. It's by individuals. And I'm not saying there are individual Satanists who practice, you know, the things slightly off. No one Satanist is just exactly like any other. But we all have the same ideals and general mindsets.
Right.
And
so
I believe
those
are part of the key elements that separate Satanism. And whereas you might say, not every witch is Wiccan, but Wicca, if you follow it specifically from, say, Gardner, there are exacts that have to be followed, or you just, you know, so many people out there will say, I'm Wiccan, and they're not from a particular tradition, so no, they're not.
Right. I think a lot of people just kind of say it in more of a way to sound cool than actually mean what they're saying.
Yes, that happens with almost everything, really. I mean, how many people say, well, I'm Christian, but they can't really say of what type. They don't have, and I'm not saying, you know, coming from that background, because I grew up Protestant as a child. There isn't, you know, you have to do this, you have to do that. within Satanism, but there is a general acceptance that this is what we all think like. Mm-hmm. We don't go out looking for members. Members come to LaVey's book and say, oh, that's what I am. And it's not like you're brought up in a satanic family, like you're brought up in a Catholic family or a Jewish family or something like that, and you just automatically become. Satanism is a lot more selective. We like to say that we only take the cream of the crop, people that will question and who are creative and challengers of everything, because not everybody will measure up to what ideals we hold true.
Well, that, and it also makes it seem like it's more respectful to other people's beliefs, whereas, you know, in certain Protestant religions or Roman Catholicism and some other religions, you have to recruit, as if, you know, everybody's just a barbarian, and you once they see the light of Christ, then they're fine.
We're quite the opposite of that. We don't want everybody, because, like Nietzsche would say, the herd that exists out there is full of rabble that are ignorant, that, you know, are so hateful and mindless. We want the cream of the crop. We want people who will think for themselves, that will be creative, that will pursue the highest that they can be. And there's very few people out there that are able or willing to do that.
Yes, there are very few.
So do you find out of, like, I know as a Christian growing up, to talk to a Satanist or to become a Satanist would be like a huge, huge no-no. And as Christian that we, or at least as Roman Catholic, I guess I should say, they were very against that. Do you find there are certain other religions that are a little more accepting to you than, say, what I grew up with, like our Wiccans, because they're of the occult, a little more accepting and understand more?
I think that even though Wiccans have been persecuted by, you know, Christians, you know, and witches in general have been, it's rather difficult to say. You'd think that they would identify with us because we are the devil in the world, but they don't. They've gotten so used to the burning times and not being accepted and trying to fight for acceptance in the normal world that they want to point the finger and say, but we're not them.
Right.
You know, they don't want to be identified with us because we are clearly the bad guy. They want to be accepted. So they're trying to shuffle over to the other, you know, end of the spectrum and saying, we're good people, like the Christians. We just believe in God being in nature instead of just God. Whereas right. Christians are awful because they worship their inner spirit, their own power and confidence, and that makes them evil and threatening to most others.
I think to... When I was growing up, I think a lot of it was, just like me, the impression a lot of people get, not really looking into it, not knowing their facts, they think a Satanist is strictly a devil worshiper.
Yeah, that goes out and hunts little children and animals and, you know, sacrifices them.
Well, unfortunately, so, it's the Luciferian types that give real Satanists a bad name. And we, of course, are quick to defend ourselves and say we're not them. It seems to be the way of things.
Uh-huh. So we're going to take another quick break here. I think it'll be about a five-minute break. And for all those who just came in, we're talking to Corvus Nocturnum. He is the author. He is a Satanist and a vampire.
And a great man and friend.
Thank you.
Of course. That's understood.
Well, yeah, because we talk to all really cool people that are, you know, hopefully listening and will, you know, give us a few perks for allowing them on our show. But anyway, as you were saying.
Alrighty then. You're listening to Paratrinity Radio on the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network.
Where nothing is sacred.
From Residual Hauntings Live. As some of you may know, I have run a paranormal group and website for several years. After walking through unwelcoming buildings and ominous cemeteries at night, the biggest challenge I've faced has been finding quiet. quality website hosting on a very tight budget. HostSureGhost.com is a high-quality hosting company specifically serving the paranormal community. All HostSureGhost plans include ad-free hosting, email accounts, and an easy-to-use control panel. With packages starting at just $4.99 a month, we scare away the competition. So stop watching your money vaporize and let us host your ghost at HostSureGhost.com.
This is Don Shy, the parapublicist, and you're listening to Paratrinity Radio, where nothing is sacred.
All right, and we're back. And, yeah, you're listening to Paratrinity Radio, and we're talking to Corvus Nocturnum, great guy, great friend, and author, and vampire and Satanist. And while we were gone, we had a question in the chat room that I need to find.
It was a great one.
It was. I'm just going to read it if I can. The herd mentality was based on the idea that everyone within a specific group will follow the same morals because of fear of deviation. How does one determine... I lost it. Dang it. How does one determine if that person is a fit for membership to your group? And I assume she's referring to the Satanism.
Right. That is a very good question. And I would have to say that Satanists do take a quiz, you know, so to speak, when they want admission within the COS. And it asks them general questions like a psychology personality test to see if they're a good fit. And as long as you exhibit traits of free-thinking individualist who shares their ideas of anti-herd, original, you know, pursuit of creative intellectualism. I mean, they'll ask you, why do you like the things that you do? And, you know, if you say, well, because it's popular and it's trendy, well, that's the wrong answer. That's being like the herd. The herd that Nietzsche's talking about is the brain-dead majority who buys into everything that they're spoon-fed through the media. You know, LaVey ranted against television, saying that one day it would become the great babysitter of our society, and he's right. Whatever pop culture, you know, churns out, like Twilight, you know, millions of people go to it, and they think, ooh, vampires are cool and sexy, and they sparkle in the daylight, when the kids out there, to this day, haven't read the classics like Anne Rice or Bram Stoker's Dracula. No. They haven't a clue as to what classics are. Satanists usually appreciate history and the richness of what others have done beforehand, whereas most of modern society is so driven by what is expected. They have no originality. They have no creativity. They only do what they're told. They only do what other people say should be popular. Be like right. Us. Wear our shoes. No. A Satanist creates their own identity. That's why you'll never find too many of them that look alike, that act alike, although we are mostly better dressed, educated, you know, polite people. We put ourselves out there as being a notch above because we do feel we're better. We call ourselves the alien elite because we try to be better than others. That makes us elite. We're alien because we're so different than most other people. It's sad that in the old days, someone would dress up when they went to school. They would dress up for a job. They would be polite to their neighbor. And that's what Satanism usually is. Most of the higher-ups, the higher up you go, the reverends, the magisters, those are the peoples in the three-piece suit. They may be black suits, you know, because it's scary, but it's still a suit. It still commands respect and power and authority.
Unlike nowadays where you go into some corporate settings and you see more than you bargained for. It's like, you know, people stop commanding respect for a sexual, what is the word? you know, sometimes you'll see women with the extremely short skirts or, you know, the very, very low-cut shirts, instead of, you know, basically commanding respect for themselves.
Well, I would agree and disagree with that when it comes to Satanism, because LaVey wrote a book on the Satanic Witch, and it was all about women using their sexuality and sensuality as a weapon against men, because it is a male-driven society.
Yes.
And if you can use your looks and your intelligence together, like my wife says, you know, she points at her cleavage and she says, all this and brains too, you know, you stop and think about it. And there is a power there. You get men to listen to you or not listen to you, and you still get ahead, and you have the brains to outwit them. Because women do tend to be a little bit more intelligent. They're better shots if they're police officers or in the military, because they have more control over what they're doing mentally instead of being driven by their testosterone. So women truly have more power than men if they know how to use it right. Most just don't. So
that's what I was referring to, is that a lot of times it seems that they don't quite understand the difference between being sensual and sexual and just overboard.
Right. There's a matter of practicality and pragmatism. You don't want to look like a slut out in public unless your job is a stripper and you're trying to become, you know, wealthy off of just your looks. I have no problem with strippers or porn stars. They're taking money from stupid people because they know that's what the majority wants, and they live a good life. I'm not saying they're all, you know, intelligent people. I've met several. I have a couple that are friends, and I don't count them as the most intellectual people, but they are smart enough to use what they've got to get ahead in life. I would have to say that when a woman dresses nice and shows a little bit of cleavage or a hint of leg, they capture attention, but they aren't lost totally in the whole slutty aspect. But they've still got that slight hook in to their boss, and they move up in the ladder, and they still look professional. They still use their brains, and, you know, they climb over their boss. They become the boss. They run corporations. So,
unless it's female against female, and then you kind of have a different dynamic, but yes.
But the idea of using your sensuality and sexuality to get ahead is part of satanic magic when they talk about what's known in Satanism as lesser magic. It's about using psychology and people's emotions and feelings and preconceived thoughts against them. That's why a Satanist will go into a crowd dressed in a three-piece suit and say, you know, I am powerful. And they'll get ahead because they blend in, but they're not conforming. They're using classical tastes to not look like the metalhead. Because how many metalheads in their 40s have actually made something of themselves?
Well, right. Let's not talk about those statistics. well, I mean, there's a lot of them that haven't. I mean, I always thought that I did conform a bit when I was younger because of pressure. And then when I think about it sometimes, like, you know, a lot of teenage girls are in the 80s and 90s would have their hair to the ceiling, their
bangs
at least. And, you know, I never wanted to do that. I never saw the point in ruining my hair just so that I could say it was up to the ceiling.
Right.
And I never understood quite some of those things. And, you know, as you talk, it actually kind of makes sense that maybe, hopefully, I actually was using a brain at that point in life.
Now, it sounds contradictory when I tell people, dress up because you get ahead, because it's what is expected in a power society, that's conformity. It's not. People that want to look like MTV in whatever subgenre of music, those are the conformists. They're not really being themselves. They're being what they think is popular. If anything, wearing the nicer clothes and, you know, being polite in public is becoming the lesser of the norm. But people still acknowledge it. And, you know, you hold the door open for someone when you go into a restaurant, and they'll look at you in shock almost anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they will. Especially, like, I do that all the time for other, you know, people, men or women, and they look at me like I just landed from the planet Pluto. Well, ex-planet Pluto.
Corvus, I'm going to backtrack here a little bit, and I'm going to throw out a question for you, one that with past guests have actually popped a question into my mind. Satanism is a very me-centric, I lack of a better term, religion or belief system. Atheism is very much along those same lines, very me-centric. How do you Yes. differentiate yourself being a Satanist from an atheist?
Because we have a little more structure in how we're objectionist, we have the dark trappings, you know, the skulls and the devil head and the darker clothes, whether it's black or burgundy or purple. There is a certain codification or structure to it that you can easily follow, whereas an atheist will just say, I don't believe in anything. That's wrong for a Satanist because we do believe in certain things. We believe in very specific ideologies of the me first. It's about being selfish. It's about the ego. It's about the individual's will when conquering. Those are prized qualities. But anything in extreme can be a downfall.
Well, like we were addressing during the break, what most people did not hear was that Satanism is me-centric, but at the same time, you live in the now. You live in the moment because tomorrow may never come, whereas atheism doesn't really care about the moment. It's just me, and I don't believe in anything other. Does that seem about like a good summarization of that?
Right. Atheists don't have to, you know, prescribe to anything, and they don't have to push for success. They don't have to try to enjoy the moments in life.
They don't really always seem to enjoy many moments, if any.
A lot of them tend to be bitter people that just say, well, I don't believe in anything. I don't even believe in myself. Well, a Satanist does believe in themselves. They believe in themselves more than anything because we have to deal with ourselves. We have to live for ourselves. And that's not saying that selfish is bad. I'm quick to point out to people that if you're a person who thinks for yourself and takes care of yourself, you're going to be there for your kids more. You're going to take care of your animals. You're going to take care of your home, which in turn, you live as an example for others to follow.
Right.
You're healthy. I mean, you're happy. And people are like, wow, how come that person isn't wallowing in self-pity? It's because they're putting themselves first, and then their loved ones, and then their friends. It's a chain that trickles down.
And that's something that a lot of people don't quite realize, that it's okay to, you know, love yourself. And especially in religions, that, you know, it's always, it seems to always be taught that you have to be, you know, giving everything.
Right.
Yourself.
From Christianity to Buddhism, Taoism, where people feel, you know, you have to suffer for the world because everyone else suffers. It's not good to be happy or think of yourself because others are less fortunate. And that is true to a point. There are people that, you know, have less than you. There are people in third world countries that, you know, they're living in terrible conditions. But you know what? Like I said before, I was homeless 20, 30 years ago. You know, you pull yourself out of it. You live for better. You work hard and you strive for more. You know, the only person holding you down is yourself. No matter what your obstacles, no matter where you live, you can fight for a better tomorrow. As long as you feel you should keep fighting. That's up to you, too.
Yeah, it is. Because, I mean, no matter how much you pray, it's not going to fall on your lap.
Exactly. I have nothing wrong with prayers and people who do a ritual, no matter what their faith is.
Because that's not what I'm saying.
That's a projection of what you want to accomplish. It's you have to put some follow-up into it.
Right. And that's the part that I'm referring to, is that just there are so many people out there that just, you know, sit there and pray. And, you know, if I pray, it'll be better, instead of just working hard, too. You can pray, but you still have to work at it. You can't
exactly.
just assume that everybody's going to give it to you. when you work hard, yeah, things will start to fall in your lap because you are earning it yourself.
I know one of the things that you guys were asking about earlier before the last break about religion and the supernatural, paranormal, things like that.
Yeah.
And I wanted to touch upon that since, you know, we're running a little low on time, I noticed. I was a consultant for Paranormal States episode called Satan Soldier on A&E a few months back. And what I said during the video clip for that is the Church of Satan's stance on possession was officially formed during the time of the Poltergeist movies. We feel that these people are deluded individuals and they claim possession because they either have mental issues or they're desperately crying out for much needed attention. Megas Gilmore, the high priest of the Church of Satan that took over after Anton LaVey's death, he says there is no evidence that is convincing to him of any conscious survival after death. The rare ghosts that are experienced seem to be a residue of strong individuals who died under extreme duress. And I'd have to say that I agree with that, especially when I happened to catch an old Ripley's Believe It or Not, where I believe it was Jack Palance, who was host, said that there was an old ghost town that they did some research into that was haunted, and they heard the clinking of pool balls in the hall late at night. And it was really spooky and everything, and they could hear the murmur of voices. And what it turned out to be is the vibrations, the energy of that happening was embedded in the lead paint in the walls, and it was resounding back again and again like a record. And, you know, I thought that was just fascinating, that that explained part of it.
So and do I knew, you not, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Do you not then, well, how would you describe an actual, say, smart haunting? Terrible term, I know. Thank you.
Intelligent.
Right. I would love to see something like that. I'd love to see, you know, evidence of it. I'm fascinated by the paranormal. I got into it as a child, you know, with my grandmother who loved ghost stories and the Bermuda Triangle and things like that. That's what kind of piqued my interest in being different and a Satanist instead of being, you know, flat out an atheist and questioning everything and saying nothing exists. I like the spooky. I like the idea that there might be a little more than what we can see with the naked eye. But I believe there is a scientific explanation. We just haven't located what it is
yet.
Yeah, we haven't discovered it yet. There might be residual aspects of a person that gets left behind. We all know through science in high school that there's an energy in all things. It's not just metaphysical New Age kooks. It's actual science that there's energy and electricity in the body. When someone dies, the electricity's gone. The consciousness is gone. And what I feel is people that encounter ghosts, they're encountering that residual leftover of the person's consciousness that is in its borrowed energy. It's what returns to us. It's the energy field that's left over that kind of wafts around, but eventually that fades away too.
So do you think that there could be a ghost of a live person, so to speak, if you were to do the same thing every day, same time?
I don't know. That's a really interesting hypothetical. I believe what you're getting at is kind of like imprinting.
Yeah, it's kind of like what you're saying as far as leaving the energies behind when you die.
I mean, if you go
when
into...
When you're alive.
Right, right. I mean, when you go into a room where people have been arguing, you can feel the tension.
Yeah.
You know, if the people say, well, you can cut the tension with a knife, they're picking up on that extreme projected anger and hostility. And I believe that people do emanate that emotion and that drive and, you know, their feelings. So, you know, perhaps the cases of haunted houses isn't demons, because we don't believe there are demons any more than there's no devil. It kind of falls into, you know, logical chain of events. But it doesn't mean the energy of people that were before wasn't left embedded into the home. And when you have places like, you know, haunted cemeteries or insane asylums, you got to remember the architecture was designed to bring out a sense of foreboding because of the people that were there in old prisons and things like that. So you're going to get that residual feeling with everything else.
Could it also be just, you know, certain people kind of having a longing for their deceased ones and maybe projecting their own energies?
I think that has a lot to do with it. It's part of the, you know, the people that you want to feel sorry for because they can't let go of their emotions because they miss someone so bad. And that's why in Satanism we cherish the people that matter to us in our lives, because if they are taken away from us, we will honor their memories by enjoying our lives and remembering the good times. You don't have to cling to sorrow for the rest of your life, because the person who died wouldn't want you to be wallowing in, you know, that type of negative feeling if they really cared about you.
Right. Which, you know, Wow, I'm great at speaking tonight. It never made sense to me, you know, back in the 1800s when, or, you know, before, that when a spouse died, the woman had to be in black for years and years of mourning. And,
right.
You know, yeah, I love my husband, but if he drops dead, I'll be sad for a while, but after some time, I have to move on at some point. And it's not fair to me to, or his memory, to be stuck in a rut.
Right. I kind of liken it to a couple years ago before my birthday, my oldest dog that I loved very much died. And I don't disrespect that dog's memory because I have a new one that I love too. Mm-hmm. But I'm never going to forget the good times that I had.
And I see that, Lord, and I think that is key. In that, you know, just because you may remarry or get a new loved one, have another kid, doesn't mean that you forgot the ones before.
Right.
And I think that's where some people kind of get confused that, you know, well, if you move on, that's disrespectful.
I think it's what the person or animal, you know, would want for you.
Mm-hmm.
So you might have kind of answered this already, but I'm going to ask you. As far as ghosts, when I think of a ghost, I think it's a spirit or someone's soul. Do you believe in the soul or a spirit at all?
I kind of identify the soul or spirit to be the will of the individual, the energy of their psyche. So to some extent, yes, there probably is something like that. I just don't call it the same thing.
So would you say you believe in ghosts, or you just believe in the residual energy, as you mentioned?
I lean more toward the residual energy aspect because I haven't encountered anything to prove to me there's more.
Okay.
All right.
So you're open to the possibility of more.
Yes, we're open-minded skeptics about everything. If you can prove it to me, I would love to see it, and that would be, you know, something awesome. That'd be like the first man going into space. Just because somebody said the world's flat and there's nothing else, the first person who said, well, that's not true, and could prove it, that was just amazing. So uh-huh. I'm not ever going to say nothing is true. We're taught as Satanists to question everything.
And growing up, my mom always said that you should question everything, but keep an open mind as right. to, you know, and understand that nothing's impossible, just improbable.
Your mother was a very smart person.
Yes, she is. I think she's brilliant. Too bad she's not hearing that, so she can give me nice a pat on the back for saying that to her.
New to Ted director to the podcast at the end of the show.
But
so as.
Go ahead.
Sorry, didn't mean to cut you off. Okay. Like, the atheistic point of view is you die, you're buried, you rot in the ground, and there is no afterlife, and that's that.
Which is actually kind of miserable when you think about it.
It is, but don't dwell on the negative side of it. If you do, you're not taking into account the things that you do leave behind, and that's all up to you as an individual, too. if you've lived a happy, full, productive life, you know you're going to die eventually, so make it, you know, the best you possibly can. Like, I'm an artist and a writer. I leave behind the works that I've done for people not to forget about me. The lives that I've touched, whether they're my best friends, my family, or people who read my books, you know, halfway around the world. That's me not feeling so bad when it's my time to go. You know, we leave behind us, you know, our children and our accomplishments.
That's
what's going to happen. That's going to, you know, be that way with anyone, no matter what their belief system. That's the practical, logical reality, is our monuments and the people and children, those are the things that will be left. You know, so why not live your life to the fullest right now? Enjoy yourself and enjoy those people, those children, those animals that are with you.
All right. Well, we are coming up on the end of the show here, which is kind of past it. So before we go, I definitely wanted to give you a chance to really plug yourself, let people know where to find you, how to contact you, where to find your books, blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
Whatever you want to say. It's all yours.
My personal website, where people can find all of my books and my own podcast, is www.corvusnocturnum.com. My books are available from my website, from the publisher website, darkmoonpress.com, and they're also available on Amazon.
All right. So I guess that brought up another question I've always been curious about, and if this is up to you whether or not you want to answer this, but I'm assuming Corvus Nocturnum is not your birth name.
Right, that's a pen name.
Does that have to do with your Satanism or vampirism, or is that just something you came up with just for...
That's something I came up with to reach out to my fans, and it was also something that I felt was very much a part of my nature. If you're familiar with the aspects of crows, where Corvus comes from, that's pretty much another long discussion all by itself. But the root words of the name itself and being nocturnal, because I prefer the quiet of the night and, you know, not so much noise and confusion and traffic and so many people. I've always loved nighttime above daytime. So, you know, it's
rather peaceful.
Things. Right. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of put all those together, and, you know, I may drift away from my pen name eventually and use my initials and last name on future books, but, you know, we'll see where that goes.
So is that the name you use, like, say you go to a job interview or something? Or is that only what you use when you're...
The interesting thing is I got so used to signing my pen name for autographs over the years that when I did have my last job and I was given my first paycheck, I almost signed my pen name to the back of the check.
So that's just what you use. That's just what you use in the paranormal field and for your books and stuff.
Right. I mean, a lot of my best friends and fans, they come up to me and they say, "Hey, Corvus, how's it going?" You know, or the people that are trying to be respectful will say, "Warlock Nocturnum, how are you?" You know, through MySpace or Facebook, you know, things like that. And people can find me and, you know, talk with me there. I love my fans, dearly. They've been a big part of my life. If my fans are out there, you know, write to me. And yes. I will write back.
We do love our fans, because without our fans, we are nothing.
Well,
we're something, but we're not famous without our fans. Well,
not
famous. We're not famous yet. But we will be.
That's true.
So I've noticed a lot of the people, I don't know if they're vampires or what they are exactly, but like... listening to your radio show, which is on every first and third Wednesday of the month. It's called Embrace the Dark.
Right.
It's here on ASPRN. But I've noticed that a lot of your guests have pen names as well.
I wouldn't say they're pen names so much, but they are their online pseudonyms. Raven Digitalis, is a pen name, but Joseph Laycock, is his real name. so there's exceptions, you know, here and there. You know, it depends on the individual. They all choose how they best want to identify, you know, right. Who they feel they are inside. And that's one of the biggest things I want to impart with people is live for yourself. Live, you know, for who you are. One of my final thoughts is that even if you believe in multiple lives, think about this. Think about the people you've touched within your own lifetime. Doesn't matter if you live 1 or 100 times, as long as the life you're maintaining right now is lived to its fullest. You know, enjoy your existence and the people that are close to you.
Yep. Pretty good way of summing it up.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to come up with something good after something so eloquently spoken.
Well, I am a writer. I have to be eloquent once in a while.
That is true.
But I would like to thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us tonight.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it. And
usually I thank people for being willing to stay up so late, but I assume this is normal for you from what you've said. So. But it's been an honor speaking with you, and I have learned a lot that I was completely ignorant on before. I knew nothing about before, so it's been...
Well, by my first book, you'll learn a whole lot more and probably have tons more questions.
Oh, yeah. I'm
definitely
sure.
Will look for it. And that's on Amazon and all the major online retailers?
Yes, darkmoonpress.com and amazon.com.
Okay.
I would say more people order directly from me through Dark Moon Press and Amazon than anywhere else.
All right. That sounds good. So we're going to wrap up the show here. And
what color paper did you want?
The wrapping paper?
Yes. You said to wrap up the show.
SpongeBob wrapping paper.
Okay. Yellow and blue.
like I said at the beginning of the show, we are actually not going to be live next week. There might be a podcast playing, might be music playing, might be nothing playing. I'm not sure, but we have a family obligation that week, so we will not have a show. And
that weekend, we're not going to be gone the whole week.
That Saturday night, we will not be here. And the following week, I don't know if we have a guest yet or not. I'm still waiting on confirmation. So I can't tell you who our next guest will be.
But, yeah, I hope that we get confirmation soon. Otherwise, we got to bug Chris again.
Yeah, we got to find someone. So we will be here in 2 weeks live on the radio, just like today. And until then...
Actually, we're not really live. It's a figment of everyone's imagination.
Right, so, until then, thank you guys for listening. Make sure to check us out at paraternityradio.com. If you missed the first half, check us out at paraternityradio.podomatic.com. I had a brain fart there for a moment. And you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and MySpace. And we're everywhere. And thanks. And you've been listening to Paratrinity Radio.
Hold on, I gotta prepare.
Where nothing is sacred.
You can't say it meanly. Good night.
Tune in next Saturday night at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to Paratrinity Radio with Mike and Ellie. Paratrinity Radio, where nothing is sacred, right here on the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network.